All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. And once again, a packed show because there's so damn much going on in the world today. All right, at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with John Deans, Arctic campaigner with Greenpeace, on the oil company's plans to drill for oil in the Arctic, where there's a 75% chance of a major oil spill, all right, which could be and would be extremely destructive and impossible to clean up. And in the middle of the show, we're going to be talking with Travis Morales from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network about Obama's recent immigration reforms. And opening the show up, we're going to be talking about the recent developments in Ferguson, Missouri. Just after the grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri, refused to bring back an indictment against the murdering cop who killed Michael Brown back in August, I had to
that began all this with the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, ignoring the fact that police in that area killed Kajimi Powell, a mentally disturbed young man who was holding a butter knife, and that was the reason to blow him away, and then later kill Von Derrick Myers. When an off-duty policeman did a pedestrian stop on him and his friends and ended up killing him. This has been going on for far too long, and it is right on time that many, many people are saying, not going to take it anymore. I mean, right now as we're talking, thousands of people are marching through the streets of New York City. They've blocked the entrance to the Lincoln Tunnel. They've gone from there to descend upon Times Square. Earlier today, 300-400 people in Cleveland blocked both sides of the expressway that runs through the city there. People all across the country are taking to the streets and raising in a very loud voice, no more police murdering our youth. This is long overdue. It's very important, and it needs to be continued and built on and developed into a movement of resistance of millions of people just saying, this horror must stop.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about, too, though, it's interesting because as you're watching this and you're watching the faces of the people as they're standing there and they're listening to this long oration by the, you know, the prosecuting attorney, you know, you're listening to this whole presentation he's making, and people, you know, in a sense, it was still such a shock, even though they must have known, they must have had some sentiment that it was like going to come down this way, but still the slap in the face to hear that there's not going to be an indictment against this pig. What did you think about this whole situation with the grand jury? What was your take on this whole grand jury hustle?
To talk about the grand jury, look, the grand jury and impaneling it was part of the cover-up of the murder of Michael Brown. Because here you have a cop gunning down an unarmed black youth who he knew was unarmed. You have eyewitnesses, you have ear witnesses laying out how it happened. You don't need a grand jury and months of investigation to determine that this needs to be taken to trial. You indict the killer and you take it to trial. What we got instead was the grand jury process being set up, prosecutor taking it in there, but refusing to act like a prosecutor because he brings a killer in, but he does not say to the grand jury, here is what this case comes down to. He never suggested this is what this case is about. He threw a lot of evidence at the grand jury, and even more than just throwing evidence, the prosecutor savaged anybody who said this was a crime. You heard how he talked about the witnesses who were saying that Michael Brown had been murdered. He called them liars and people who were imagining things. And then he talked about Wilson's testimony before the grand jury like it was the gold standard. And one thing that came out when they did the dump of all the testimony was that the prosecutors never asked Wilson a single question. He was allowed to run out his narrative about how he was frightened, how Michael Brown was like a demon. He was like a giant. He was crazed. Not a single question was posed around this, including they didn't get into the fact that Wilson changed his testimony because before the grand jury, he talked about having been punched a certain number of times. At the grand jury, he changed the number of times. The talk about how bad he had been beaten by Michael Brown didn't really match with the photos that were given. But none of that was questioned. There were no questions posed to him, no challenges to his credibility. He was just allowed to run it out. And that's because the prosecutor was setting up a process whereby Wilson would not be indicted. And then he goes beyond that to call into question the credibility of anybody who testified that Wilson did anything wrong in order to undercut the possibility of any further legal proceedings around this. So it was both a punch to the gut to hear, even though, and look, I was real clear as things were going along, you know, they were calling out the National Guard, they were calling for peace. I'm like, they're just about telling us we're going to let this murdering pig walk. Then when it happened, it's still a slap in the face. And then they add insult to injury with this advocate for Wilson, because he wasn't really a prosecutor, he was an advocate for Wilson, gets there to pontificate for like 20, 25 minutes about how anybody who doesn't see the truth that Wilson was really the one in fear for his life, he did nothing wrong, was lying or making stuff up. This was like insult to injury, and it really shows what happens when you let this system work, because when it works, official brutality and murder gets a stamp of approval. And again, it's built into the fabric of the system. It's been there from the beginning. The forms have changed. The way in which they punished the enslaved Africans wasn't exactly the same as the way they used lynch mob terror to keep the black people who had been freed from slavery in line. And it isn't the same as the way they terrorize black and Latino youth in the ghettos and barrios today. But it's the same program. It's the same deal. And it's built into the fabric of the system. And that's why I say it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to get rid of it once and for all.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder, along with Cornel West, of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about the decision of the St. Louis County Grand Jury to let Darren Wilson, the cop who cold-bloodedly murdered Michael Brown back in August, to let this killer cop walk free. Now, Carl, I know that that's actually something you've been arguing a lot for, people to actually step up and be part of that movement for revolution. And you've also been saying to people in relation to this and other things that actually there's also a time to act now that
right
is not
now
necessarily separated from that, but is actually can be part of that, but is also something that's very critical right now in terms of people not standing on the sidelines, but actually getting out into the streets and in different ways, showing their opposition to what went down in Ferguson.
Yeah, because this is a which side are you on moment. I mean, because the people in Ferguson, the heroic people in Ferguson who stood up in August and refused to silently accept the murder of Michael Brown, they changed the terms of things in society around police murder of black people. They put it on the agenda for everybody to look at, and then the system comes back with a stamp of approval for that police murder. This means that everybody has to say, where do I stand in this? Am I okay with the fact that this system gives a stamp of approval to police murder, or am I opposed to that? And if you're opposed to it, it's not enough to be silently opposed to it. It's not enough to mention it in the company of your family and friends. You got to step out into society and add your voice to those who are saying, this must stop. Mm-hmm. That's why when people are taking to the streets, blocking traffic, blocking highways, others need to join them and stand with them and support them in all kinds of ways. Students need to be walking out of school or turning their schooling into lessons on the way in which this system brutalizes and murders people and what can and must be done about it. Athletes, musicians, you know, other professional performers, they need to be canceling appearances or turning their appearances into speaking bitterness about what was done to Michael Brown and what's been done to all the Michael Browns, male and female, black, Latino, Asian, white, whatever nationality, all across this country and adding their voice to the call that this must stop now. And that is directly related to building a movement for revolution, because we in the Revolutionary Communist Party, our approach to this is fight the power and transform the people for revolution. And we do that, and I'm doing that real hard right in this situation as well as all along. But also, whatever you think about revolution, you have to ask yourself, is it okay that police can wantonly brutalize and murder people, and especially black and Latino people, and especially the youth? And if it's not okay with you, then you have to stand up, and you have to be part of saying no more to this.
All right, Carl, you know, one of the things I was going to ask you, and I think you started to hit at this, but I'd ask you a chance, and I'll give you a chance to actually wax poetic on this, man, because there's something that struck me. In the aftermath of a lot of the righteous anger that is expressed in your recent writings about what happened in Ferguson, how this cop, this murdering pig, as you put it, has been let go, he's walked, and that basically people are now told to just rub off your face, get rid of the tears, and go back to life as usual. You've said that, look, what's at stake in whether or not people stand up against this is the very world that we will live in. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, it's both. What kind of world do you want to live in, and what kind of people do you need to be? Because we are being told that this is the norm, get used to it. Go back to suffering it in silence. We're being told that on this front of police murder of black and Latino people and the savage oppression that comes down on those groupings and others in society. We're being told that in terms of attacks on the right to an abortion on the part of women. We're being told that on many, many fronts. And we have to say, no, wait a minute. This is not the world we want to live in. It is not. I'm not the kind of person who is going to see this injustice right in front of my eyes and shut my eyes to it, whistle and walk past it, trying to convince myself that I didn't really see it. I am not that kind of person, and this is not a world that I will consent to live in. That is the stand that people have to take. And look, I just got to say that was the message from the dialogue that Cornel West, my co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, recently had. And it was a message that really hit home with me, but also with many, many other people in the audience. And look, people need to take to the streets. They need to get out there and act. They need to spread the word through social media. Go to the website revcom.us. You'll find my writings and much, much more on this and other aspects of the way in which this rotten capitalist system is coming at people here and around the world and what we can and must do about it. Go to the website stopmassincarceration.net and see what people are doing around the country and join them in acting.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
All right, take care. Talk to you again soon.
Okay, bye.
Bye. All right, we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about recent developments in Ferguson, Missouri. And I normally take a quick musical break here, but this time it's going to be an extended musical break because I want to play a song for you. It's something from Oscar Brown Jr., the late, great Oscar Brown Jr., and it's a song called Brown Baby, and I think it concentrates a lot of the horror of all these beautiful children that have been sacrificed in the jaws of this barbarous system. Oscar Brown Jr., Brown Baby.
Brown Baby, Brown Baby, as you grow up, I want you to drink from the plenty cup. I want you to stand up tall and proud. I want you to speak up clear and loud. Brown baby, Brown baby, brown baby, as years roll by, I want you to go with your head held high. I want you to live by the justice code. I want you to walk down the freedom road, brown baby. Now lie away, sleeping. Lie away here in my arms while your daddy and mommy protect you and keep you safe from harm. It makes me glad that you will have things I have never had. When out of men's hearts all the hate is hurled, you in a better world, brown baby.
Welcome back. It's Oscar Brown Jr. with Brown Baby. Yep, and it's a dream about a better world, and it's a dream about a better world that gets expressed in a world that's a horror and really needs to be changed. All right, and recently President Barack Obama unveiled his immigration reform plan, at least that's what he's called it. But to anyone with an ounce of sense, an ounce of discernment at their disposal, all you had to do was take a look at it and say, what the hell is this? Joining us to talk about all this is Travis Morales. Travis is from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Travis, how you doing, man?
Fine, how you doing, man?
I want to jump into this right away. What's your overall take on the Obama immigration plan?
Well, in listening to the speech, both what he had to say and the plan, it's full of lies, hypocrisy, dripping with American chauvinism, and bragging. I mean, we have to be clear. He was bragging about what he has done to secure the U.S. border, which translates into he's bragging about that they have increased the hunting down and rounding up of desperate and hungry people, starving people who are coming to the U.S., crossing that border, driven here by the crimes this country has committed in their home countries, coming here trying to survive. And he's bragging about it. It translates into bragging about the hundreds of people who are continuing to die at the border every year from a conscious policy of border militarization, which is driving people to cross through the most dangerous deserts and river crossings and through the mountains. That's what this speech amounted to.
That was really striking. A lot of that, all of that was striking, and especially the point where he's talking about, well, what have I done to deal with the immigration question? And the first thing he talks about is the militarization of the border and the increased repression and oppression that occurs at the border on a daily, hourly, minute-by-minute basis.
Exactly. I mean, I was reading some different figures, and the Department of Homeland Security is saying since 98, 5,000 people have died. Others are saying as high as 8,000. But whatever the number is, it's an atrocity. It's a crime against humanity. People dying from the heat or from the cold in the mountains. And this has been a conscious policy. And this is what he's bragging about, is this increased border militarization. The drones, there's 21,000 Border Patrol agents now. They've got all this high-tech equipment that they've put at the border. And again, this is what he's bragging about. And in this speech, it was like, okay, I'm going to give some of you a temporary respite, a temporary protection from deportation while I'm increasing the border militarization, which is going to only result in even more people dying at the border.
You know, and it's weird, too, the way it starts by talking about this broken system and then going on to really sort of rub raw a division among immigrants, you know, and creating it, but then whipping up a lot of resentment around what are labeled as the bad immigrants as opposed to the good immigrants, which is a very dangerous division that we've seen before in many other circumstances.
Exactly. In the speech, or in the what he's announcing, this executive order, the 5 million or so people who can apply for this temporary, again, temporary protection from deportation, which could be immediately yanked out from under people when the next president comes in, and they would have registered, 5 million people would have registered with the government, telling them that they're here without papers. So there's that, but there's also this whole thing, but we're going to go after felons, we're going to go after criminals. They've been bragging about the fact that since Obama came into office, over 2 million people, I think it was 2 million as of the beginning of this year, have been deported, supposedly because these were criminals, when in fact study after study has shown that the majority of people, it was either misdemeanors or people hadn't actually committed any crime, and they were deported nonetheless. So they're creating this myth and this nightmare of, oh, we're being overrun by criminal aliens. This includes people who've been deported once and have come back into the U.S. and been captured. But this point you're making about creating these divisions, it's very much a question of divide and conquer, of trying to paint some immigrants as bad that we can do all these horrible things to while we're going to hold off from doing them to you in the time being. Sets up this whole mindset of people going along down this path of increased repression, of criminalizing of whole peoples because they've come here trying to survive.
You know, it's interesting. The Onion, which a lot of times has a way of like really sort of getting the essence of what's going on and then pointing it out in a way that just makes it so patently absurd. They had a piece that they ran in the aftermath of Obama's speech where it says, quoting an undocumented immigrant supposedly, it says, "When I came to this country 11 years ago, it was in the hope that one day, if I worked hard enough, I could be granted a temporary tenuous reprieve from the threat of being forcefully removed," which is essentially the essence of what he's done.
Exactly. And to quote the Big Bad Wolf, the Little Red Riding Hood, "All the better to eat you with, my dear."
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's look a little bit more at these points. One of the things is that, again, the additional resources for law enforcement at the border regarding the attempt to stop the flow of illegal crossing and speeding up deportations of those who do get across. And all this is being run by Homeland Security. You know, the fascistic sort of protector of the homeland is running the immigration reform program. There's something very, very evil about that.
People should stop and think of the Department of Homeland Security has something like 200,000 employees. It's the largest law enforcement agency in the country. One branch of that being Customs and Border Protection, which is 60,000 agents, including the 21,000 Border Patrol agents. But then in addition, there's another 20,000 ICE agents, Immigration Customs Enforcement. This is 80,000 agents that have been turned loose on people who have been driven here from other countries. And the very people whose job it is to round people up, to criminalize them, to put them in detention, to deport them, these people are now supposed to be administering a program that's, oh, providing protection against people. I mean, that's like putting your life in the hands of the Gestapo or something in Nazi Germany if you were Jewish,
mm-hmm.
frankly.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Travis Morales from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about Obama's new immigration reform plan. Now, Travis, one of the things that's really very interesting, because there's this whole point around, and I want to dig into, like I said, these three major points, but there's related to this first point, there's the point that some people have pointed out as like, oh, this was really a great advance, that the plan actually effectively ends the Secure Communities program. What do you think of that?
Well, several things. One is, again, this is temporary.
Well, tell people what the Secure Communities program is as well.
Okay, the Secure Communities program was set up by the feds to where local law enforcement, county police, city police around the country, that when they pick someone up and they thought that they were undocumented, they would hold those people and tell the Immigration Customs Enforcement that they had these people, and through that, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have been picked up and deported. Not because they committed some horrible crime, but because they happened to be arrested for something, which they may have been convicted of or may not have been convicted of, but they were then turned over to the feds for deportation. And it's a situation where somebody's driving down the street. You know, this happens various times where men would take their children to school and drop them off, get picked up by ICE, and then deported. or they would be picked up by the police for a seatbelt violation or for whatever reason, and they would think they were undocumented and they would turn them over to the feds for deportation. That's what this means. It's part of people living with the constant daily threat of any run-in with law enforcement could end up them being deported, their family split apart, them being sent back to Mexico or El Salvador or China or some other country, and their families left here with no way to survive. That's what this program actually is.
You know, one of the things that's interesting, too, in relation to this whole thing is that while he's doing all this in relation to the broad category of immigrants, he's also opening the door and the arms of the country to techies and entrepreneurs, which is kind of...
Right. And when you look at what he was saying, I mean, the starting point of all this are the needs of and protecting the U.S. capitalist imperialist empire. That's what this is about. I mean, you just mentioned allowing more entrepreneurs, more people with high-tech skills into the country to work for companies like Apple or Microsoft or whatever. But at the same time, opening up this temporary protection to, it was about 5 million people total, 4.1 million of those, the parents of children who were either born here and are citizens or people, their children who have permanent residency. But again, this is temporary. It could be yanked out from under people at any time after they've given all their information to the government about where they work, who they are, where they live. It's a very dangerous procedure they're setting up for people.
That's a very important point that you raised about after they've given all their information, because that was a huge point in the whole speech. There was a whole emphasis on, okay, we're talking about how are we going to deal with immigrants that are living here illegally. And there's a whole emphasis put on we have to have accountability. And again, it poses the good immigrant versus the bad immigrant. And it's, you know, the whole question of who's bad. But then the idea of people have to sort of go down to the SS office and register.
And they're painting a picture of, you know, Obama says in his speech, he's talking about the fact that people have broken the law. We are a nation of laws and immigrants, and people have broken the law by coming here. So first of all, they're painting all the 11 to 15 million undocumented people here as having broken the law. They're all criminals. And now some of them are given the opportunity to supposedly atone for that by paying back taxes, by paying fines, by going down and registering. And it's just, to me, the height of hypocrisy for the U.S. to be talking about how people have violated the law by crossing over into the U.S., violating their borders, when this country goes all over the world violating every other country's borders, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, the fact that they stole nearly half of Mexico in a war of conquest 180 years ago. I mean, where do they get off talking about people coming here and violating the laws? I mean, they've got people in Guantanamo held for years without charge. They torture people. They're spying on people and hundreds of millions of people in this country in defiance of even their own laws. And they want to talk about desperate, hungry people that they've driven here because the U.S. has, well, I can't curse on the air, but what they've done to totally destroy the economies of places like Mexico under NAFTA, where millions of farmers have been driven from the countryside because they can't compete with cheap U.S. grain. I mean, we could go on and on about this, but I just wanted to make this point about the hypocrisy of them talking about immigrants violating the law by crossing this border.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Travis Morales from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about Obama's new immigration reform plan. That's an extremely important point, especially that point about why do people come here in the first place, and it has everything to do with the kind of savage oppression and distortion that the U.S. hammers down on these countries all over the world. I saw it firsthand in Mexico when I was down there during the Chiapas uprising. I also saw it all throughout Africa, you know, where everything is geared towards whatever's going to make the profits for the imperialists, and the entire economy gets distorted. And people can't survive. They can't live. They're driven to leave their countries, their loved ones, their culture, their homeland, everything. It's just sort of they're driven by this essential need to survive that the U.S. has made the imperative of their life.
Right. And here's a big contradiction. I did want to talk a little bit about the animosity within the government between the Democrats and the Republicans, which is really a reflection of huge disagreements among the people, the ruling class in this country. They're not all united. They have big disagreements. They're united around that this country has to control, repress this huge number of people who've been driven here from other countries. But they have big disagreements on how to do this. And part of their contradiction is they really do require a huge pool of deeply exploited immigrants for the functioning and profitability of their overall system. If you look at construction, if you look at the service industry, huge sections of the economy are totally dependent on super exploitable immigrant labor. I mean, I just know from times in Texas, you drive around in Houston and you see all these construction sites, whether it's highways or buildings or houses. It's all Mexicanos who are the workers. I mean, that's what they're dependent on. But there's a big contradiction because there's all these people who've been driven here not because they love America, but because they have been living the American nightmare in their home countries. And the people who run this country really do fear the dissolution of the social cohesion of this country that's grounded in white supremacy, male supremacy, and English only. And that's a big part of what's driving both this disagreement and Obama to come out with these measures. Sections of them feel that something has to be done to try and control this situation, to bring people, as they say, out of the shadows where they can be registered, where they can be much more controlled.
Yeah, that's very, very important. And including, I was thinking about this in terms of when you talk about, and you mentioned it a couple times in the course of the discussion, you were talking about the sort of the very temporary status that all this affords people in the first place, that it affords the good immigrants in the first place. And the fact that, yes, people, accountability means playing by the rules, and what they get is deferred deportations. That's a fairly heavy point. There's limits even there on who's eligible. And eligibility does require actually registering, which is a very important point when you think about this whole temporary process. And you get the right to work and you get a deferred deportation. And these deferrals, as you pointed out, are very temporary and they have to be renewed every 3 years. So it's very, very much a very calculated, very sort of inch by inch stepped out plan for how do they actually deal with that contradiction that you were talking about.
Exactly, exactly. And I think we have to ask the question, what kind of country is this? What kind of system is this that goes all around the world invading, bombing, destroying the environment, destroying the economies of whole nations, like in Mexico, where people have been driven to El Norte to try and survive, and then people are hunted down like modern-day slaves, but hunted down to be deported back to the starvation and misery from which they fled. I mean, to me, there's a whole other discussion to be had, which we don't have time for today, but I think this question of it is, when you have a system like that, it's one that needs to be overthrown, that it is going to take revolution, nothing less. And I would direct your listeners to check out the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America from the Revolutionary Communist Party draft proposal that talks about how at the time of a revolution in this country, that everyone who is here will be afforded citizenship, unless they're war criminals or they've actively led in opposing the revolution. But everyone here will be afforded citizenship. And people from other countries who want to come here, who want to contribute to the building of a revolutionary society, are going to be welcomed. They're not going to be hunted down. They're not going to be put in solitary confinement. They're not going to be deported. People will be welcomed to be part of building a whole new world. And I think people should think about that in contradiction to what Obama was saying last night and what these plans are.
Exactly. I think that's a very good point. And I think that's actually a very good spot on which to wrap this up, man. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And people should go to revcom.us to check out what Travis has to say about this whole question of immigration and for a revolutionary analysis of the entire world, okay, and how we're going to change this thing. Travis, thanks a lot, and hope to talk to you again soon, man.
Thanks a lot, man. Talk to you soon.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Travis Morales. Travis is with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. He's also written extensively for Revolution Newspaper, and he's been very involved in the fight around the immigrant rights and against the oppression and repression and militarization brought down against a whole people who have been driven from their countries to come in and serve this imperialist monster. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with John Dean's Arctic Campaigner talking about what the hell is going on in the Arctic Ocean and the Arctic in general with all that oil exploration. You don't want to miss this one. Stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Thievery Corporation with Sound the Alarm, very appropriate for this next segment. Yesterday, I had a discussion with a man named John Deans. He's the Arctic campaigner with Greenpeace, and we were talking about the criminal acts of drilling for oil in the Arctic. So without any further ado, check this out. All right, as people may have been following, Barack Obama has been in the forefront of paving the road for huge oil companies to dramatically step up the destruction of the planet. The continued and indeed increased deep water oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, the establishment of offshore oil drilling on the east coast of the U.S., and most horrifically, and I do mean horrifically, greasing the skids for all-out oil drilling in the Arctic. And while there have been some protests and concerns voiced for the most part, they have been ignored. Recently, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management issued a new report on the situation. And here to talk with us about that and the overall situation as well is John Deans. John is an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace, and he recently wrote, "Federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do." John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
Tell me this, man, real quick. What did this new report reveal, and what's significant about it?
Sure. Well, this report is something that was required by the court. An environmentalist sued a few years ago that the federal government, when they offered this lease sale in 2008 under the Bush administration, had not properly considered the environmental impacts. And so this is their latest attempt to try to clean up their record on the environmental impact statement. And this statement lays out a whole laundry list of impacts, but a couple of the most shocking highlights are the government is saying if Shell finds oil, if there's oil production that happens in the Chukchi Sea as a part of these federal leases, there's a 75% chance of an oil spill, 75% have a large oil spill. So that's over 1,000 barrels. And they assume that there will be 800 small oil spills. Now, that's a massive impact on the local ecology. That will affect the food systems for marine mammals, for the fish. They talk about distinct species of salmon being destroyed. So it's a massive impact on the local ecology. And, of course, extracting more billions of barrels of oil out of the Arctic Ocean is only going to exacerbate climate change that's destroying this sensitive area.
Now, one of the things they also said in the report was that the report actually was changed because it raised the amount of the recoverable oil that
right.
they could that they were saying was there in the Arctic. What's the significance of that? I mean, it went from, 1 billion barrels to 4.3 billion barrels?
That's correct. The problem is that the government had based their environmental impact statement on the potential spilling related to a billion barrels of oil being extracted from the Chukchi Sea. And as environmentalists argued and the court agreed, it was an arbitrary and capricious estimate. And so in this newest report, they've gone through and said, well, we think that 4.3 billion barrels is how much economically recoverable oil will be taken out. And that's out of about 12 billion barrels that they estimate are economically recoverable in total. They just think that 4.3 is the likely estimate for what would be extracted. And so we're taking a hard look at that and examining their methodology. This is a very complex report. And so we're trying to poke the report in any way we can to try to make sure that they are, in fact, giving a realistic estimate.
Mm-hmm. Now, the difference between that and the original report, which said 1 billion, what is the point here? Because I understand it was because when they were putting the lower amount, it was basically meant to indicate or imply that there's really not that great a danger of some massive catastrophe.
Yeah, that's right. They're trying to sort of brush this under the carpet, and this is the second time they've been taken to court, and it's the third round of this environmental statement that they've drafted. So hopefully they'll get it right this time. We'll see if third time's the charm. But yeah, that's basically it. The more oil that comes out of the ground, the higher the likelihood is for a spill, and the larger the impact could be of that spill. And so those things need to be considered. So we saw the percentage jump from, I think it was 40% chance of an oil spill up to 75. And at 75%, I mean, those are good odds. So you can basically expect that there would be an oil spill if production happens in the Chukchi Sea.
Yeah, I read a couple of pieces that said it's pretty much a given. If drilling starts, there will be an oil spill.
Yeah, that's certainly what we've said all along, and the government's finally catching up to that. And the thing about the Arctic, as you said, it is horrifying because, I mean, look at what happened in 2010 with a deepwater disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. A just absolutely horrific impact. And look at what happened in Prince William Sound with the Exxon Valdez. These spills are bad enough in areas that aren't iced in for the majority of the year. But when you go up to the Arctic Ocean, they're basically saying, the government put out another report earlier to the National Academy of Sciences that looked at what we could do about an oil spill. And essentially, the leading scientists on this said, we can't clean up an oil spill in the Arctic. We don't know the basic science behind how to do it, and we don't have the equipment. So basically, the government knows that 1,000 barrels of oil or above spills in the Arctic Ocean, and most of it's going to stay trapped in the ice.
Yeah, I read somewhere where the U.S. Coast Guard has actually admitted that they have zero spill response capability in the Arctic.
Yeah, there's virtually no oil response capability. I mean, there are they set up a couple of stations along the coast there, but it's just there's not enough equipment, there's not enough training, and like I said, there's not enough understanding about what to actually do. And the scientists were saying so bad that we want to go up there and burn oil to see what happens, which of course would be a disaster in all of itself.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm going to get into this a little bit more in a little while, but first let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with John Deans. And John is an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace. He recently wrote, Federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do. Now, John, one of the things is there were four companies that originally were involved in this whole scene, and I guess there still are, but the only Shell Oil has attempted to develop their leases, and they were forced to stop. And I think it's important for people to understand why they were forced to stop, because it's indicative, or it indicates what is possibly the outcome of beginning to drill oil there. Why were they forced to stop, and what's the current status?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Shell Oil is essentially the icebreaker for the industry in the U.S. Arctic waters. And yeah, all the other companies, ConocoPhillips, Statoil, and others have said, well, we're going to see what Shell can do. And so far, Shell hasn't done a whole lot except for mess up. They've spent over $6 billion pursuing oil in the U.S. Arctic. They had one season where they sent drill ships up in 2012. Both of those drill ships ran aground. One of them they had to scrap. One of them caught fire. And it was just a complete mess. And that was just to sort of drill some exploratory, what they call top holes, where they're not even getting into the layers of the rock under the seafloor that have oil in them. And so we've already seen that a company has 100% success rate in completely messing up their operation. So we're going to include that as one of the things the government should take into serious consideration and say, look, you've got a perfect example of oil major going up, completely messing up their operation. So the likelihood of environmental impacts is really huge.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I'd like to get into, you know, it's kind of heavy because the environmental impact is, I want to talk about it in general first, because it's actually, it involves so many things, including like the increased shipping. And I read somewhere where even something like that, where ships will end up discharging ballast waters and they're discharging microbes or whatever from other oceans, other seawaters, and what that would do to the ecology in the Arctic. But the impact of drilling in general, in terms of the damage that would do, let's talk about that for a minute.
Sure, yeah. In 2012, as Shell was making their way up to the Chukchi Sea, we actually sent our ship up there, and we did some exploring, and our campaigners and scientists went overboard in submersibles and surveyed the ocean floor, and we actually found higher numbers than anybody had predicted of the seafloor being covered in corals and brittle stars, and that whole ocean floor ecology is much more vibrant than had been previously documented. So it's a very vibrant area, but it's also very sensitive, and everything up there relies on everything else. And so if you start destroying the ocean floor and you start, you know, harassing animals with increased ship traffic and even the small oil spills, all of that adds up to a really huge impact. And in fact, one of the things we've also done, Greenpeace and others, other environmental organizations, have now sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife because they're basically going to give Shell Oil carte blanche to harass walruses and polar bears. And the drilling site is right near a critical habitat for walrus in particular called Hannah Shoal. And it's the ship traffic, it's the noise traffic, it's the harassment that could really lead to some really horrible consequences. And in the case of walrus, we've already seen that they're scrambling to find places to haul out. 35,000 just a few months ago hauled out. And it's a huge story. And they had to come out on land when usually they're trying to haul out on ice. So there's multiple impacts, and they add up.
Let's move on to the impact of a major spill. That's the thing we've been talking about. We started off the conversation with that. What makes it so dangerous in these waters? What makes it so dangerous that you could actually say, well, there's going to be a spill if they start drilling? What is it that makes it so dangerous? I've read things about floating icebergs, the freezing conditions. Yeah. Can we talk about that a minute?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, the issue here, the central issue is that climate change is affecting the planet. We all know that. There's no disputing that. But when you look at the Arctic, the effects are so much more extreme and so much more rapid. Temperatures rising multiple degrees. And what they're saying is that opens up the waters, which is true in a certain extent. But that doesn't mean that they're ice-free. So you have these massive floating chunks of ice in the summertime, which is the drilling season. And these rigs have to be designed so that they can pick up and leave at a moment's notice and be towed away or float out of the way of an iceberg. And it's just a very hard place to work from that angle. And also, you have a really short drilling season. So you basically have from July through October, 4 months, to drill. So what happens if a spill occurs in October? You don't have much time before the ice starts coming in and before that equipment needs to get out of there for fear of being destroyed. The water is colder. The oil reacts differently. The specific type of oil that they might find acts differently than, say, how it might act in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's a very unique environment. It's very harsh weather. And a perfect example is that when they moved their drill rig out, it's called the Kulik, it ran aground because it went right through a winter storm. And the seas, I mean, we've all seen Deadliest Catch and what the oceans are like off the coast of Alaska. So that's what you should be picturing when you're picturing trying to drill for oil in Arctic waters.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with John Deans, an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace. And he recently wrote, federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do. John, you know, it's very heavy when I was reading up on this. The point about if spilled oil got under these large bodies of ice, there's just no way to contain or clean that up. And those and toxic traces can last a very long time and travel very long distances on ice flows.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the document, actually, the report that the government released looking at the environmental impacts is really shocking. I mean, you look at the impacts of the oil, and they talk about whales inhaling toxic gases that are coming out of the oil. They talk about polar bears being saturated in oil, losing flotation and the ability to stay warm. And this stuff lingers. We were in Alaska just a few years ago with some scientists digging into the layers of sand in the waters surrounding the Exxon Valdez spill. And there's a layer of oil there. So, yeah, this stuff sticks around. It volatilizes, so you get emissions into the air. It sinks into different parts of the water column, gets spread all over the place, coats marine mammals. It kills their food, the microorganisms, and fish that they feed on. So it spreads everywhere, and it's a horrible disaster to imagine.
Mm-hmm. I want to also revisit this point about the wholly inadequate response from oil companies to this danger. I read where one senior official in a Canadian oil company said that there really is no solution or method today that we're aware of that can actually recover spilled oil from the Arctic. And yet Shell says it can clean up 95% of a spill, while the U.S. Geological Survey says 1 to 20%. And they point out that the Exxon Valdez was actually, the recovery was only 9%. And in Deepwater Horizon, it was only 17%.
Right. And consider the Deepwater Horizon was in warm, relatively mild waters of the Gulf of Mexico compared to the harsh, cold, and stormy waters of the Arctic. So, yeah, I mean, those claims are absurd, and they're couched in very feeble science. And like I said, in April of 2014, just this year, the National Academy of Sciences, the best scientists that we've got, the National Research Council said, yeah, we don't know enough. So the leading scientists trying to deal with oil in different conditions don't know enough about how it will act in the Arctic. So having a company say, oh, we can clean up 95% of it is just absurd. And nobody really believes that. But the thing is, this is the moment where the Obama administration could take a real stance. Obama has just made very big claims on climate, is now starting to enact a lot of things. This is one area where they can say, look, you know, our own research, the court made us go back. We had to look at this. And our research is saying there's a 75% chance of a spill. We could be decimating populations of sensitive animals like threatened ducks that are protected under the Endangered Species Act. This project doesn't need to go forward. This is too dangerous. There is an opportunity here for the president and his administration to step up and really put their money where their mouth is and say, you know what, this area is off limits. We're not going to drill it. It's too dangerous. And can't afford to have more hydrocarbons and carbon going in the atmosphere.
Of course, then he'd have to deal with the situation that he just opened up all those oil drilling in off the East Coast and the increase in the deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, even in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, and it's absurd to think of opening up areas on the East Coast. And that still, you know, we have a chance to stop that, too. And people really need to get engaged in this. This is a very good opportunity right now for people to engage on these issues and say, no, look, we're going to draw a line in the sand. We're going to draw a line in the ice and say, you can't go further. This is enough. We've got there's deployable renewable energy. There's a whole new way we can charge our economy. We don't need these fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you one question around that, because it's very important that people know that Greenpeace is actually out there fighting this, on the front lines of this, and I was reading recently where you had the Arctic 30 was a group of Greenpeace volunteers that were out there fighting the same sort of drilling, and I think it was in Russian waters or something?
Sure. Yeah, just over a year ago, the area of the Arctic that's most under development right now is the Russian Arctic, and a state-owned oil company called Gazprom, who partners with companies like Shell. There are all these partnerships between corporate oil companies and the Russian state-owned companies. They had a drilling rig in Russian Arctic waters, and they still do. And our activists approached the oil rig and attempted to climb it. Were approached by Russian authorities who fired warning shots into the water around them from their guns, held them at knife point, dropped from a helicopter onto our ship, arrested the ship and its entire crew, and threw them in jail for a few months. And thankfully, they were granted amnesty as millions of people around the world cried out for justice on that. But a horrifying experience trying to suppress free speech. And, you know, our activists were incredibly brave and, you know, went right up against the threat, because who else is going to do it? That's why we're out there. We need to confront the sources of these problems. We need to bring the world's attention to what's happening, because the oil companies and the governments that they've bought and paid for want to keep this stuff in the dark and want to just keep on making billions of dollars.
Yeah, and just as a final thing for you to comment on if you want to, I'm just reading about Shell's spill response plan for an accident in the Chukchi sea waters, and it was recently approved by the U.S. government, and here's what it says. It's basically, the assessment of it says, even a quick read shows that the company would be entirely unable to respond to an accident in the high north. In fact, it's more like a negligence plan than a spill plan, depending on a capping and containment system that hasn't even been built, on deflection barriers that will not work properly on ice, and with onshore cleanup plans that look like they've been drawn by children. At the same time, we hear that Shell is also paying to train dachshunds to hunt out oil trapped under the thick layers of ice. Need I say any more?
Right. Well, and to add to that, well, I'll give you more, which is that in 2012, their oil spill containment device, which is basically, it's something they put over the hole that's intended to shut things down if anything goes wrong, tested in calm waters, not up in the Arctic even, crushed like a beer can, was the headline. So the device that they're relying on to be able to stop a blowout doesn't even work, let alone in Arctic conditions. So it's absurd, and we've challenged their oil spill response plan. But the problem we have here is that a lot of these decisions are political. Under law, the government can rubber stamp these projects, even if they're going to, you know, have massive environmental impacts. And that's why it's so important for people to send the message to the Obama administration, to the Department of Interior, and say, look, you know how bad these environmental impacts are. It's time to cancel this. It's time to close off these waters to oil exploration.
All right, John, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, take care, man. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again, probably sooner than you think, okay?
Anytime. I'd love to.
All right, man. Take care now. Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with John Deans. John is an Arctic campaigner for Greenpeace. He recently wrote, "Federal agency says Arctic drilling would likely cause disaster. Here's what you can do." And folks, we really need to stand up and do something, because these monsters are going to kill the planet. All right, well, that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Carl Dix, Travis Morales, and John Deans. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. But before I do that, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, and now, again, each and every one of you for tuning in, and please keep tuning in each week, and let me know what you think about this. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to check on how you can actually respond in the most revolutionary way possible to all the stuff that's hitting us in the world today, don't forget to go to revcom.us. And for those of you who haven't had a chance to see or hear that dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian, you can listen to it up on the revcom.us site. You can actually watch the dialogue. It's really a killer, so don't miss that. We're going to go out now with "We Are the Ones" from Boots Riley and the Coup. Talk to you again next week.
We are the ones. We'll see you faint, tear down your stake. Go get your weapons. We came to fight. It's your disgrace. Smash up your place. That's just polite.
What's up? upon a time when crack was gold and hip-hop was not yet platinum sold. I scoured the streets for stacks to fold. My mood like my hair was relaxed and blowed. I hated police and my teachers were beasts. My heat in the trunk of the classic Caprice.